Hey everyone, welcome back to Adherent Apologetics. I'm so pumped you joined us today. Today I have Michael Jones from Inspiring Philosophy, and we're going to be talking about the Gospels. Michael, thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Good, good. Well, do you want to start? Just talk a little bit about like who you are, like what you do, things like that.
Yeah, my name's Michael Jones. I run Inspiring Philosophy, and I do a lot of Christian apologetic videos. Right now I'm doing a series defending the Gospels, so that's what I'm doing. Basically on my channel.
What got you interested, Michael, in like the Gospels and like the apologetics behind it and like the theology and whatnot?
Well, I believe they're true for one thing. So I think that's just going to cause a deep appreciation of them. And I was also interested to see if the evidence supported them when I was still sort of searching and trying to figure out if Christianity is true or not. So I've always had sort of an interest in the Gospels. For a long time now, just because of the foundation of the Christian faith, really.
So, Michael, like, just to get started, like, broadly speaking, when we're talking about the Gospels, what are we referring to?
So, the Gospels, the four canonical Gospels, are four biographies in the New Testament about the life and teachings of Jesus. So, they cover his ministry. There's a few stories about him before he started his ministry, like the infancy narrative, the story of him in Luke, about him getting lost in Jerusalem. And then it goes up to his death and resurrection. And so the four gospel authors basically recount the life and ministry of Jesus.
So the gospels then are like these people who are writing about like the life and death of Jesus, and like they're trying to give like an accurate account of what's going on then?
Precisely. They're trying to tell us what Jesus taught, what he did. How did he die? When did he resurrect? They're trying to just give us all the basic understanding of who this person was and why he's in their view, I would say, the most important person in history. He is the Messiah, the foundation of the Christian faith.
So, like, why think these gospels then are, like, accurate accounts versus, like, stories? Like, we read stories all the time about people that are meant to be, like, fictional accounts just to, like, entertain us. Why do you think, like, these are accurate accounts, that, like, trying to portray, like, you mentioned the word, like, biography. And, like, when I hear the word biography, I think, okay, history. Why think they're, like, historical or accurate accounts?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. There's a lot of ways to look at it. For one, we know that ancient authors wrote various works. We know they wrote biographies, histories. They wrote novels, fiction. And so there's different genres of the ancient world. For the longest time, the belief was that the Gospels were some sort of like their own genre. They sort of like stand out as like some sort of like Christian type documents. They don't fit into one of the genres of the ancient world. And then Richard Burridge, about 30 years ago or so, who is a classicalist, he made the case that no, the Gospels actually fit into the genre of Greco-Roman biographies. Now, that's important because if you're going to write a biography of someone, you wouldn't write something that was fictional. You were trying to basically interview eyewitnesses to obtain accurate information about who the person was. And if you had no eyewitnesses alive, you would sift through documents about the person to try to figure out who they were so you could pass on accurate information. Recently, the scholar Craig Keener has noted that in the ancient world, we have no biographies about someone written within the lifetime of the eyewitnesses that were fictional. So you could write a fictional biography, but you would do it 100 years later. We don't have evidence of someone trying to write a biography about a person that was fictional within the lifetime of eyewitnesses who knew him. Why? Because people in that day and age, when the eyewitnesses are still around, could correct information. It would have seen as less reliable if you go against what the actual living memory was saying at that point. And so you could have a fictional biography, but it came much later. The Gospels are written well within the lifetime of the eyewitnesses and disciples of Jesus, especially the first three canonical Gospels. So with that, I mean, we have a good reason to think that whoever wrote them was trying to give us accurate historical information.
Okay, that's helpful, Michael. So one of the things you brought up that I think was really interesting, and I don't know if it's a point that I ever knew before you just brought it up, is this idea that, okay, like fictional accounts of people only occur after their lifetime. So referring to the Gospels, and like if this is the case, Michael, you said that like the historical works at this time are only fictional after their lifetime. So if that's true, like with the Gospels, then like why, like would we think that, like what's the case that the Gospels were written around the lifetime of Jesus? Because at least they have to be written like after his resurrection, right? Because they include the resurrection. So like what's kind of like the time frame here with that point?
Yeah, that's a good question. So most scholars date the Gospels to roughly between 70 and 100 AD. I made the case that the first three synoptic Gospels date earlier. They date to roughly 60, around 60 AD is my view. So that's generally what I take. And there's some reasons for thinking that. One of the big reasons is the way that Acts ends. So when we read Luke Acts, we see that Luke recounts the story of Jesus, and he recounts the story of the early church. And then he brings Paul in and we see a lot of stuff about Paul. Paul, he goes here, Paul does this. That basically Paul becomes the main character in the last chapters of Acts. And then we see this big epic thing building up to Paul is going to go to Rome and he's going to be able to present the gospel to Caesar himself. And it's this big triumphant thing. And then we read at the end of Acts, he goes to Rome and he lived there 2 years at his own expense. The end. If this was fiction, the author of Luke Acts was a horrible writer because you built all this foreshadowing of Paul going to Rome to bring the gospel before Caesar, and then it never happens. So scholars going as far back as Adolf von Harnack have argued that this would be an indication that this is when Acts was written. So roughly around 62 AD, that's when it was finished, before Paul went to trial. There's no reason for him not to include that, given this climactic buildup to it. Now, if that's the case, that means Luke had to be written prior to that. If Mark was a source for Luke, Mark had to be written prior to that. So you have three books of the New Testament prior to like 62, 64 AD, roughly, which I think is strong evidence that they're going to be well written within the lifetime of the eyewitnesses. Then you get to Matthew, and Matthew does some interesting things. For one thing, he talks about the proper way to make a sacrifice before the temple at the altar. He talks about that. If that was written before 70 AD, that would make sense because you would be arguing for or trying to teach Jews or pass on teachings Jesus gave for how to perform rituals in the temple properly. That would be a pointless thing to include after 70 AD. So Charles Quarles has made the case that this means Matthew also has to date prior to 70 AD. Matthew and Mark are also quite nice with Romans. So it's seen, which is different from what we see in the book of Revelation. So the argument he basically puts out is that, you know, these seem to be documents written prior to the destruction of the temple, prior to Christian persecutions. So you're getting them roughly at the end of the 60s is what I argue. And then I think John did come after that though.
So then like building a case for like the Gospels being like historically reliable, like is like this idea of like them being early, is this like the main argument that you kind of bring forth? Like, okay, like they're early. We can see this from Luke Acts and its abrupt ending. And if they're early, then it's like if they're early, that it's very likely that they're reliable. You're muted, Michael. We're missing what you're saying right here.
Yeah, not necessarily. You could have an early document that is unreliable. You have a late document that's reliable. We don't just, you know, that's just, we would expect that it could help with probability that if it's closer within the lifetime of eyewitnesses, it's going to be more reliable. That can help support that, but that doesn't necessarily prove that. There's other indicators we can use to show the Gospels are reliable. Go back to eyewitnesses. For one thing, let's look at the way that Matthew and Luke use Mark or the Q source. We know in that ancient time that biographers were free to use literary devices. They could transplant speeches. They could spotlight someone. They could put words in someone said in someone else's mouth. They could transplant events, move chronology around. We see, you know, Josephus does this even with the Hebrew Bible. But the interesting thing is that the Gospels use their sources more strictly than Josephus uses the Hebrew Bible. So it seems as though Matthew and Luke had more reverence for Mark and Q than Josephus even had for the Hebrew Bible. That tells us also is that they were interested in passing on accurate information, not changing things to fit a narrative, to fit an agenda. They were trying to be very strict and follow what they had. I argue that sometimes they did use literary devices, but not at a point that we see other ancient biographers using. They were far more strict in that day and age compared to other biographical writers. And they don't drastically change things to fit narrative flow. They stick very much to what their sources are that they had.
So, like, Michael, would you say that, like, Mark is the first gospel written then? Is that your view?
Yeah, correct. I would say that Matthew possibly wrote something early in Hebrew that we has lost, but it was like a sayings list. And then the first actual gospel of the four canonical gospels was Mark.
So then, like, if we're thinking about it, Mark being the first gospel written, if that's the case, then like the synoptics, like adhering very closely to Mark. I know sometimes people use this as like an argument against the gospels, but like, you think it's actually an argument like for the reliability of the gospels, that like they closely adhere to Mark?
Yeah, well, the church tradition is this is the preaching of Peter. And so you have Matthew and Luke trying to stick closely to what Peter taught. He's the prince of the apostles. They're not, and that would be evidence that they were trying to use accurate information that went back to Jesus, not just make things up to fit their need.
So then, Michael, I just wonder, like, also, like, there's also this question to me about, like, the reliability of, like, memory. So, like, it seems like the Gospels were written, like, after, like, the death and resurrection of Jesus. So then if we're looking at the question of memory, then, like, is memory going to be reliable here when we're looking at, like, when the Gospels are written down, if they're written down after, like, all the events about the life and death of Jesus actually happen?
Yeah, I mean, well, for one thing, in the ancient world, people had much stronger memories. People could memorize the entire Iliad or Odyssey. I mean, Jews would memorize entire parts of the Pentateuch. This is just what people did. But also, it's very, people don't realize how strong their own memory is. I mean, you could probably recite song lyrics from songs you haven't heard in like 10, 15 years because it has that rhythmic nature that flows and we go, aha, yeah, yeah, I remember that song now. People do that all the time. Well, we know scholars like David Ahn have noted that like so much of the synoptic material is written in a rhythmic nature, is what he says is a parallelis mumbarum. So it has like this rhythmic nature, like ask and it shall be given you, knock and it shall be open. These kinds of rhythmic features that Jesus taught in. And this was how rabbis taught in the day. It allowed their disciples to memorize things at a much better rate. So a lot of it's not a question of were the disciples able to memorize. The question is how much could they memorize? Given that in that culture, that is the kind of that fostered strong memory development, and the gospel authors are citing a rabbi who just taught in a very rhythmic fashion.
Is there anything else, Michael? Like when we're bringing up a case for like the gospels being like accurate or like historic accounts, is there things that haven't brought up that you might think would be relevant here for people listening?
Yeah, so recently Luke Vandeweghe started publishing on this. He published on the idea of sorry about the cat in the back. He is very annoyed right now. He recently published on the idea of onomastic congruence in the Gospels, and this is looking at naming patterns in the Gospel. So you have to think, though, if you were going to write a fictional account of, let's say, the state of something that happened in the state of Georgia in the 1960s. Okay, do you think you could get an accurate naming pattern that represented the right distribution of names from that time? So, you know, you get enough, like, you know, you want to find out what the most popular name was at that time in Georgia and make sure that's the most popular name in your document. So in the ancient world, Simon and Joseph were very popular names in Judea in the first century. And then less popular names were names like Matthew, Lazarus, that is. Not as much of a popular name. So you want to get the right naming distribution. You don't want a lot of Matthews and you want a lot of Simons. You want a lot of Josephs, you know, that kind of thing. So Luke Vandeweghe basically looked at this and he said, well, when we run these models on onomastic congruence, what we find is quite interesting that the gospel's naming pattern aligns with the naming distribution from the first century. If we do this with the Apocrypha Gospels, Greek novels, tragedies, they don't get onomastic congruence, surprisingly. Only the Gospels, specifically, really well as Mark and Luke show strong onomastic congruence. So what this indicates is that if someone was writing fiction, they shouldn't have onomastic congruence. Some biographies from the ancient world don't even achieve onomastic congruence, but the Gospels managed to achieve it, which is quite remarkable. It'd be almost impossible to mimic that if you were writing fiction. The probability is so low. So because they get such a strong presence of onomastic congruence in terms of their naming pattern, like Simon and Joseph are the most popular names in that time, and they're popular names in the Gospels as well. That supports their overall reliability. It's far more likely they were getting information from eyewitnesses, not just making things up.
Couldn't you say that, like, maybe, like, this is, like, and maybe this gets back into the points of, like, okay, if it's written early, then it's just, like, it's more likely to be accurate in general. But couldn't someone say, okay, well, sure, like, maybe that's not true, Michael, but maybe it's just a story written in first century Judea. Like, they're like, okay, there's this person named Jesus, and let's just kind of write some stories about it based off of maybe what someone told me, maybe it's not reliable, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's possible. But, I mean, if you're just making up stories, we know that happened. The Apocrypha Gospels did that. You know, Greek novels did that kind of stuff. They don't achieve onomastic congruence. They don't by a long shot. Only the Gospels do. So this is a strong indicator that this is basically getting information from about events that really happened. Jesus was talking to people that really existed, and these are real people that Jesus interacted with. That's why we get the naming pattern that we do. So, I mean, Josephus' autobiography gets on onomastic congruence, so it strengthens his reliability as well. It puts the Gospels in the same category with Josephus' autobiography. So interesting things like that tend to support their reliability. If these were just stories people were making up, they should look more like the Apocrypha Gospels, and they don't.
So I was going to ask you that, like, I was thinking about, like, so if we look at, like, Thomas or maybe some of these other apocryphal gospels, so from this research, it just shows that, like, they don't do as well of a job of the names in first century Judea.
Correct. I mean, they get names that are not really even used in first century Judea. They don't have the most popular name distribution. So they don't do that kind of stuff.
So we talked a lot about, like, the historical reliability of the Gospels. You also, in this, like, video series you did on the Gospel, you talk about, like, the hidden Gospel. Do you want to talk a little bit about, like, what this video is in the hidden Gospel and, like, what it's all about, Michael?
Yeah, so I was talking about these Paul's letters, basically. So people tend to think the Gospels came after Paul's letters. And for the most part, I think they're right for most of Paul's letters, for sure. And so they say, well, this means they were, you know, made up later with fictional stuff. We have no evidence of the gospel message existing in its form that we see in the gospels in the time period of Paul. But you start going through Paul's letters, you find some interesting features where it seems like he's citing earlier traditions about Jesus. One of the most famous is in 1 Corinthians 11 about the Lord's Supper. And he talks about the night Jesus was betrayed and all this stuff. So the scholar Seum Kim went through Paul's letters and kept finding instance after instance where Paul is alluding to or citing some earlier gospel tradition, not in the written form, it seems, but in some sort of oral form. So what he basically argues is it seems that Paul was very much aware of the teachings and the life of Jesus, and he sprinkles in it bits and pieces of it throughout his letters. And this seems to indicate the gospel was already being preached as it is in the canonical gospels. So it seems as though there's a continuity there. There's consistency. What we see in Paul's letters is the same theology we see in the canonical gospels. And this suggests that when Paul was writing, there was already an oral form of the gospel that he was utilizing for the writing of his letters.
So can you, I don't know, I think I'm kind of tracking with you, but, like, maybe, like, can you get a little bit more detail? So, like, is the idea of the hidden gospel, like, that Paul is, like, very, like, very much, like, espousing, like, the ideas that we do read in, like, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? What exactly is going on here?
Yeah, it'd be that. It's a lot of the ideas that a lot of the same teachings that, of course, he is a lot of the same teachings we see in the canonical gospels are showing up in Paul's letters. So, like, I could give you some examples here. So hold on, let me pull this up here. So, like, you know, when we start going through, so Paul says, for example, in Romans 13, owe no one anything except to love each other. For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. And all the other commandments are summed up in the word, you shall love thy neighbor as yourself. Well, this seems to go back to, like, Mark 12, the same teaching we see in Mark 12. Jesus answered, the most important is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and with all your strength. The second is you shall love thy neighbors yourself. There's no other commandment greater than this. And so we see that there's some sort of consistency in this idea that the law is summed up in loving thy neighbor and loving God. We see other aspects as well, where Paul seems to be aware of earlier teachings that, again, go back to the canonical gospels. Michael Patrick Barber, in his book, The Historical Jesus in the Temple, notes that we see that this idea in 1 Thessalonians 2 about him talking about judgment coming upon Paul, or judgment coming upon the Jews and everything. And he's basically using that. So he's basically using the same idea that we see in the Olivet Discourse. So his argument, Michael Patrick Barber makes, is that what we see in the Olivet Discourse is the same teachings we see that Jesus was laying down. Sorry, I got a little confused there. There's a lot of stuff happening there. Let me back up a little bit. What Michael Patrick Barber argues is what we see in 1 Thessalonians 2 is he's getting a lot of the same theology that shows up in the Olivet Discourse that shows up in Matthew 23 or Luke 11, for example. So these kind of ideas.
So then, Michael, like thinking about it then, like, couldn't someone like maybe like make an argument against the Gospels from this, saying something along the lines of, okay, well, maybe like a lot of the ideas in the Gospels are seen in Paul. And if the Gospels kind of take those ideas from Paul, like, isn't that like a sign of like maybe like the unreliability of the Gospels?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I don't think it's likely for a number of reasons. For one, if you're going to do that, you're going to be relying far more on Paul's letters. We should see literary dependence. We don't see literary dependence of the Gospels on Paul's letters. For one, go to 1 Corinthians 15, where we see Paul lists the appearances. He mentions an appearance to the 500, an independent appearance to Peter, an appearance to James. Those aren't really mentioned in the Gospels. They're not just going, all right, let's invent these appearances that Paul lists. Let's just elaborate with stories on them. That's what you would do if you were going through Paul's letters. We don't see the same literary use that we see in Paul. Paul seems to be citing an earlier tradition. The Gospels seem to be doing that as well, but it's like an oral tradition. Neither of them are dependent upon other, it seems.
So I'm wondering, Michael, like, how does this fit, like, just kind of like putting it all together here? Like, we have this idea of like the Gospels and thinking that they're accurate accounts. We have them like being reliable, written early. We have this idea of like Paul, like who seems to espouse a lot of the ideas that we do read in the Gospels in his letters, which are written, it seems to be, at least, would you say, how many of the letters would you think are written before like Mark starts writing? Or like, I mean, you mentioned like the sayings of Matthew. Like, how does Paul fit into like the dating when we look at also like the Gospels?
Well, I mean, Paul starts writing at the end of the 40s. So 1 Thessalonians, later comes 2 Thessalonians, 1 and 2 Corinthians. Romans going to be in the late 50s, I'd say, or mid 50s. Philemon is being written from Rome. So that's like early 60s, for example. It really depends. And scholars do debate about this. But most of his long letters were written definitely before the Gospels. And those are the ones we tend to rely on. So I think also Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians as well.
Did you say that, like, I can't remember if I said Mark or Matthew had the sayings. Where did you say it came? I think it was Matthew. You said that it might have like some sayings of Jesus that were written like before possibly Mark wrote his gospel.
Yeah. So this is a good, interesting question, because we see the early church father Papias saying that Matthew wrote the Logia in a Hebrew language. And we go, okay, well, that's not our canonical Matthew, because it's talking about a list of sayings, for example. And it's what our canonical Matthew is not originally written in Hebrew. It was written in Greek. And so we go, okay, well, this is interesting. But I mean, scholars also talk about the lost Q document that both canonical Matthew and canonical Luke are using. So Craig Blomberg has suggested that that could be the Hebrew sayings that Matthew wrote down. Basically that he wrote down this list of sayings in Hebrew or Aramaic perhaps. And then that was utilized in later canonical Matthew and in Luke. For the longer versions of the gospel story, taking Mark, taking the sayings gospel and combining stuff also with other eyewitness accounts and getting what we basically have. So basically people are looking at what Papias says and they go, well, that's interesting. That's not canonical Matthew. But it does seem that he's still arguing Matthew was some sort of early author. So maybe that's what this is referring to. And that's just a possibility. We can't be for sure though.
That's really interesting to me thinking about that, Michael. So I wonder then, like, I'm trying to think about how I want to, like, what I want to say here. But how does, like, Well, let's do this. A very common objection is like, okay, we've been talking about like to the Gospels. We've been talking about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But if you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, it doesn't say, oh, I, Matthew, wrote this, or oh, I, Mark, wrote this. How would you respond to that objection where it's just like, okay, like the Gospels are anonymous. There is no like author that like claims to write these Gospels.
Yeah, Simon Gathercole noted in a recent paper that that's just the way you wrote biographies. You don't mention yourself internally in the narrative. You don't just mention, I, Luke, wrote this kind of thing. They're mostly written in third person. Very few examples ever name them. Very few biographies from the ancient world ever name themselves in the within the internal main body, that is. So that's just how you would write. And typically an author would identify himself in like the title, in a tag, writing his name on the back of the scroll, perhaps. You didn't identify yourself internally. You'd always write in third person. So it's consistent with the way Matthew's writing, for example. So as well as John. This is just how you would write in that ancient world. So with that in mind, we shouldn't expect them to name themselves in the body. However, we should expect that they would have identified themselves in some sort of title, or that the scribe who was writing for them or the group that was writing for them would have identified this, the main author, in a title of some form. And this is what we tend to see in the early church. We have unanimous attestation that the four gospel authors are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They never attribute this to anybody else other than those four.
Well, Michael, anything you also want to say about like the Gospels? We've covered a lot of ground here in a little bit of time, as you've also been fighting the battle of whatever's going on with your cat. Like anything else you want to share here before we start to wrap up the show here?
No, I mean, I think there's a lot of good evidence for gospel reliability if people start looking for it. These are not late documents. I would argue that Mark is getting his information from Peter. He spots like Peter, like no other. Like Peter's motives often set up the narrative. Peter's often being the one speaking on behalf of the group or being addressed on behalf of the group. It very much seems that the way Mark is writing, it's very much from Peter's perspective. And so that would make Mark a reliable document the early church would want to use. If Matthew wrote his gospel, which I think he did, it makes sense he would want to utilize Mark because this is something that came from Peter. And he's going to want to utilize what Peter wrote. Peter was present for things like the transfiguration or praying in Gethsemane that Matthew was not present for. It says that sometimes that Jesus took Peter, James, and John further than the other disciples. So, of course, Matthew would want to utilize a more reliable eyewitness account for the writing of his gospel. We see Luke also, he seems to identify himself in the we passages of Acts on Paul's as one of Paul's traveling companions, which would correlate with the church tradition of who this gospel author was. And there's a lot of really good evidence for John as well. That Craig Blomberg's got a great book called The Historical Reliability of John's Gospel, where he just goes through every single passage and points out little facts John gets right here and there and there, and they just add up to build this strong cumulative case. So I think what we're dealing with is eyewitness accounts here at the end of the day. I don't agree it's fair to say they're late legends. They're written long after the eyewitnesses have died out. There's a lot more evidence for their reliability and that these go back to the men that are ascribed to them.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I appreciate your time. Share a little bit about like what you're doing, what you're working on, kind of what's up with you and the projects you're going through. I know you're also kind of secretive about it at the same time, I believe. But like, what are you willing to share about what's going on?
Yeah, I'm going to keep working on my series on the reliability of the Gospels. So I'm going to do one on each of the Gospels. So I'll do one on Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and just argue for internal evidence to support the traditional authorship. And I think there's a lot of good evidence that one can utilize for making those claims. And so I'm going to work on those. They should be out this summer. And then after that, I'm going to do a video probably in the fall or maybe not till the winter, arguing for the reliability of the Pentateuch, that it goes back to a much earlier period than what people most often assume.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. How can people like follow you, connect with you, things like that?
Yeah, you can follow me here on YouTube under the name Inspiring Philosophy. I'm also on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook under the same name. So yeah, you can follow me there.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I really appreciate you and just everything you're doing and just your commitment to just like rigorous like scholarship and whatnot. And yeah, Michael, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Really appreciate you and your time and everything you're doing.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And this is it here in Apologetics. I'll leave some links down below where people can follow Michael, connect with Michael, things like that. And if you like it here in Apologetics, encourage you to subscribe, leave a like, all that fun stuff. But yeah, Michael, one last time, thank you for coming on. This has been great today. I hope whatever's going on with your cat that you can kind of get that figured out. So, and thank you everyone for listening. I hope you have a good one and God bless. We'll catch you next time.